A true Kenyan success story today on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. Susie Wokabi trained as a makeup artist in the U.S. Then she went back to her native Kenya, but she had trouble getting the products she needed.
I can't keep calling my brother in New Jersey to ask him to send me this color and that. Let me just make my own. I just want to make pretty colors for lovely women. Bottom line, that's it.
And so a company called Susie Beauty was born. Plus the Kenyan slang called Sheng. President Obama may want to learn a bit before he arrives tomorrow.
Sheng represents the youth of Kenya, and the youth of Kenya really are the ones responsible for pulling it up by its bootstraps.
And Canada's buttoned-up capital, Ottawa, just might be a hotbed of infidelity. Those stories are just ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Lots to talk about today on the show, but let's start with President Obama's trip to Africa. He'll be visiting Kenya and Ethiopia. Security will be a big topic on the agenda, but he's also going there to talk trade and entrepreneurship. In a moment, we'll hear from a Kenyan businesswoman who's blazing a trail for her industry there. First, a look at the bigger picture. With a year to go in office, what is Obama's legacy in Africa? I put that question to Laura See. She's a political scientist at Colby College.
I think Obama's legacy in Africa is about the same as it is for all the other U.S. presidents before him, which is a very mixed legacy. Africa is generally a low foreign policy priority for presidents, and that's true whether they're Democrats or Republicans. They tend to value stability and security above all their rhetoric about human rights and respect for democracy. And certainly that's what we see from President Obama. It's been something that, you know, gets attention every now and then, especially when there's a crisis, but that is not a top priority. And, you know, the fact that President Obama has waited until his second term to take his trips there, or till near the end of his first term for his first trip. And now this one, I think, signals how low on the priority list the continent is.
Well, just a year ago, Obama hosted the African Leaders Summit in Washington. Was something promised there that hasn't been delivered?
Well, it's a little too early to tell. I mean, it's been less than a year since that leadership summit, but certainly there were, you know, a lot of discussion about business investments on the continent, about public-private partnerships, about the rural electrification effort that the administration is engaging in, something called Power Africa. And, you know, it's a mixed success. I think the Power Africa initiative is going well, but on the investment side, you know, there is increased U.S. investment in Africa. It seems more likely to me that investors are looking at the opportunities on the continent, and they're seeing that as attractive. And I don't know that it's necessarily because the administration says it was important or that they would have invested anyway.
You say that Obama's legacy is more or less like every other U.S. president, but a lot is being made about George Bush's PEPFAR plan. That was the plan to reduce HIV/AIDS infections and also to fight malaria. Was that not a success that Obama is now being compared to?
I think that's a fair comparison. I mean, if you look back at the Clinton administration, there it was just a disastrous Africa policy. And, you know, they failed to effectively respond to the HIV/AIDS crisis. They failed to respond to crises in places like Somalia, Rwanda, Congo. And those failures of policies led to millions of deaths and to many of the ongoing crises we still see today. Bush, you know, also didn't do a great job at handling the conflicts, but he did this PEPFAR stuff and the efforts to fight malaria, efforts to fight these diseases. He has a great legacy, and Africans really do value that and look up to it. I mean, it's many of my students today, they're so young, they don't remember when HIV was a death sentence for millions and millions of Africa because they've grown up in the era of PEPFAR. And certainly Obama, you know, gets a lot of comparison to that, but I think it's important to understand the other element of Obama's security or policy is the securitization of African policy. You know, greatly increasing U.S. military activity on the continent. But that really has its roots in the Bush years with Bush's creation of AFRICOM, the emphasis on the global war on terror or the fight against Islamic extremism. And we've seen expansion of that under Obama. And that will probably be the most remembered part of his legacy on the continent.
I wonder if we do or if we should measure Obama differently from other presidents because of President Obama's history, because of where his father comes from?
Well, I don't know if it's fair from an American perspective, but certainly on the continent, there's a lot of disillusionment and disappointment with the president. Hopes were really, really high back in 2008, 2009, that a president with African ancestry would make the continent a much higher priority than he has. He does have key advisors, people like National Security Advisor Susan Rice, who had a background in African affairs. And, you know, that policies haven't changed that much, and that in from the African perspective have maybe changed for the worse with the increased U.S. military activity on the continent. People are very, very disappointed and disillusioned. There's a lot of disillusionment with the president's support for gay rights. And we've seen, you know, there's a lot of fears about his that he's going to bring this up on the trips, and people are planning protests in Kenya, that sort of thing. But it's overall, I think, a lot of disappointment, even as people are excited that he's coming.
Okay, Laura, finally, how do you see this latest visit? What are you expecting to come out of it? Symbolic or substantive?
It's mostly symbolic. I think that, you know, he's going to Kenya, which there's ancestral heritage reasons for him to go there. It's also kind of a reward for the Kenyans for the restoration of democracy after the election violence and the theft of the election that occurred in 2007 with the violence spilling into 2008. Kenya is an important strategic partner. But then he's going to Ethiopia, which is an authoritarian state, no free speech. They regularly lock up journalists and bloggers and anyone who dares to protest against the regime. And so a lot of folks in Africa that I'm talking to are seeing this as a very hypocritical trip. But I think we're going to get a lot of nice platitudes. I think we're going to see very, very little substance.
Laura C., political scientist at Colby College. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
During his visit to Kenya, President Obama will be addressing the Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Nairobi. Investors and companies from all over the globe will be there, and so will young Kenyans looking for new business opportunities. And there are many in East Africa's biggest economy. Susie Wakabi knows. She's the owner of Kenya's first domestic-based cosmetics company, Susie Beauty. Wakabi is from Nairobi, but for several years she lived in the U.S., where she went to college and trained as a makeup artist. After going back to Kenya, she realized there was a business opportunity waiting for her. My BBC colleague Nkem Ifejika spoke with Susie Wakabi in Nairobi. She told him what the cosmetics industry was like in Kenya when she returned in 2007.
When I left 10 years before, there was no such industry. And when I came back, there was a few artists in the industry working in media, TV stations, you know, magazines, doing the shoots. And so I joined that, and we were like maybe 3 or 4 major makeup artists in the entire country. And so we were sort of the beginning of growing the industry into what it is now, because now there's makeup artists in every corner that you can look for. And there's all sorts of, you know, fashion events, fashion shows all weekend, every weekend. It's a full-blown industry now.
I can understand you're doing makeup for television and for magazines. Those are kind of like professional industries. But what are you doing here is for mass consumption, is for the ordinary person on the street.
When I realized nobody's done it here before, that means nobody's also catering to the Kenyan woman or the African woman. You know, I've used so many brands in my lifetime and always wonder, you know, why does this eyeshadow always, you know, I put it on and 10 minutes later it's gone. I look gray or pink or, you know, the wrong color. So catering to our correct skin tones and textures and correct staying power and all that, taking into consideration the humidity level, the climate and everything. So that's what Susie Beauty is. It's for us, the African woman, by me, an African woman, for the first time.
Makeup is curious because it's a reflection of something bigger. You've taken care of your rent, you've taken care of food, your kids are going to school, you have a little bit more money now, so what do you do? You can put some makeup on your face.
Yes.
And that's a reflection of what's happening in the Kenyan economy.
It is. That growing middle class is growing, you know, by the second. And there's a lot more disposable income than there ever was. And people are also, like, a lot more conscious about the way they look, the way they present themselves and all that. So the beauty industry, there's a reason why it's recession-proof. Because once a lady is hooked, she is hooked.
What sort of path is entrepreneurship for a young woman to take in modern-day Kenya? Is it... It's non-traditional.
My passion for the beauty industry is what led me into entrepreneurship. And I've embraced it and accepted it. It's very, very difficult. I can't keep on importing product. There's no affordable, good-quality product here. I can't keep calling my brother in New Jersey to ask him to send me this color and that, you know, that shade of, you know, this brand.
Yeah.
Let me just make my own.
Yeah.
And that's actually what it was. Very simple. I just want to make pretty colors for lovely women. Bottom line, that's it.
Susie Wakabi there is the owner of Susie Beauty, Kenya's first domestic-based cosmetics company. She was speaking in Nairobi with my BBC colleague Nkem Ifejuka. I'm told that there's a website called Ashley Madison, which helps users cheat on their partners. And this week, we've all heard how hackers broke into the site, revealing customer details online. One thing most of us didn't expect to find out: the high number of users in Ottawa, more than 189,000, that's one in five city residents. So the rather prim capital of Canada would appear to be, as cable TV might put it, a hotbed of infidelity. John Sullivan knows a thing or two about infidelity. He runs the Triangle Investigation Agency in Ottawa. It's a team of private investigators specializing in matrimonial surveillance. I wonder how that business is doing.
Business is wonderful. Hasn't been better in the 33 years that Triangle has been around. And what it is, basically, if you suspect your spouse is cheating, then you hire Triangle and we go out and we prove it. We actually prove the adultery situation, or we prove if they're cohabitating, obviously the adultery would happen. But even if they're just seeing someone and having dinner with someone, we prove that type of thing.
So had you heard of the website Ashley Madison before?
Oh, absolutely. We've been interviewed over the years because of that website, and there are 37 million client base. You know, I mean, it's incredible, the site.
We've learned now that one in five residents of Ottawa use that service, the Ashley Madison site, which is intended to help you cheat on your spouse or partner. What did you think when you heard that news?
You know, I was surprised that the that they use that 20% base as a figure. I thought it would have been much higher. I mean, if you give the national divorce rate is 55%, and adultery is probably 80% of the cause. So I was surprised that only 20% of the population are cheaters. It's a lot more than that.
I wonder if any of your cases have involved people who've met on the Ashley Madison site.
Absolutely. I would say I would even use their stat, which I thought is, I'm just repeating myself when I said it was a low statistic, 20%, but I would say 20% of my client base are familiar with Ashley Madison, or Plenty of Fish. That's another popular site. There are all kinds of them out there.
The number does seem kind of staggering for Ottawa, but you seem to just think it's a normal figure.
I do, and I don't think, although Ashley Madison publicly stated, I think about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, that Ottawa was the cheater capital of the world. Now, I don't know how they come up with that, because you would have to go around and ask. But I have conducted surveillances for Triangle in England, in South America, Miami, California, Hong Kong, Lima, Peru, Alaska. I've traveled all over the world doing these surveillances, and nothing really changes. It's the same population. We have 1.5 million people here in Ottawa, metro area. And I don't think that the percentage is any greater or any less than it is in New York City, or is, except Boston, because Boston, of course, is a very straight-laced town, right?
Well, that's what I thought of Ottawa. Canadians,
well,
very straight-laced, play it by the book.
We do.
So
but
what's with all the cheating?
Excitement. You've got to put some excitement into the relationship, and that people do that by cheating.
It seems like that would be the nail in the coffin of the relationship.
It is, and then that's where the divorce lawyers take over. The difference between Triangle and the divorce lawyers, we don't charge as much.
John Sullivan runs Triangle Investigation Agency up in Ottawa, Canada. John, thanks for speaking with us.
Aaron, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for the call.
This is The World.
Support for The World comes from LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorney. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter with The World. The nuclear deal with Iran might yet lead to better relations between Washington and Tehran, but supporters and critics of that deal agree it's important to keep pressuring Tehran over other issues as well. Today, a reminder of that from Amnesty International. The human rights group says there's been a huge spike in the number of executions in Iran, almost 700 so far this year. Courts in Iran are known for handing down a lot of death sentences. But this year's execution rate is alarming, according to Amnesty's Elise Auerbach.
In 2015, as of last week, Iran had already executed at least 694 people. And at this rate, Iran will far exceed the number of people who were executed in 2014, which was itself alarming. We actually strongly believe, based on evidence, that there were at least 743 people executed in Iran in 2014. And at this rate, Iran will be executing more than 1,000 people this year if it keeps on executing people at the same rate. So it's very alarming.
And what are the charges for the people who are executed?
Well, by and large, the majority of the people who are executed for drug-related offenses. Iran has one of the highest rates of heroin addiction in the world. We believe, you know, the Iranian government has a right to address this huge social problem, but execution is not the answer to this problem. But another problem is the lack of due process in Iran. So a lot of the people, for instance, who are targeted to be executed for drug trafficking are poor, marginalized people. And then they are very often tortured in custody. They're tortured in order to extract confessions. And then these confessions are used against them in their so-called trials, which do not rise to the level of international standards for fair trials.
Do you get to interact at all at Amnesty International with Iranian officials? And what do you say when what do they say when you talk to them about this?
Actually, Amnesty International has requested that they be allowed to visit Iran to conduct research missions and to be trial observers. However, the Iranian government has never granted Amnesty International access to Iran.
Okay. Now, there's been talk of linking negotiations over Iran's nuclear program to human rights and other things. Did Amnesty bring that up at all with the U.S. negotiating team? And do you think that should or should have been part of the nuclear negotiations?
Well, Amnesty International was not in touch with the U.S. negotiating team about this, but Amnesty International has always maintained that human rights should not be neglected in any multilateral negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program or other issues.
So then yours is one voice among many saying that. Why is it, do you think, that you can't make your voice heard with the U.S. government?
Well, Amnesty International directs its actions and its campaigning on Iran to Iranian government officials. For instance, our members worldwide send letters, petitions. One of our big successes was a few years ago when a Christian pastor, Yusuf Nadarkhani, had been sentenced to be executed for apostasy. He had converted from Islam to Christianity when he was a young man, about 18 or 19 years old. And there was a huge international outcry and a concerted effort by Amnesty International and other human rights organizations. And we bombarded the Iranian government with appeals. And fortunately, because I believe of the international outcry, the Iranian government did set aside the sentence against Pastor Nadarkhani, and he was eventually released.
Elise Auerbach is Amnesty International's Iran country specialist. Thanks, Elise, for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for highlighting this really important issue.
This week in Rome, mayors from more than 60 cities around the globe got together at the Vatican. They were invited by Pope Francis to discuss climate change and human trafficking. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh attended the conference, and my colleague here at WGBH Boston, Philip Martin, is in Rome to cover the visit. Philip, one of the topics the mayors discussed this week was environmental degradation, and you noticed an ironic twist to this story just walking around Rome. Tell us about that.
Well, that's right. I mean, Rome, of course, it's in the midst of a heat wave, but it's in the midst of something else, too. It's a bit of a municipal crisis with all types of bidding processes, public contracts, government contracts. And one of those contracts, of course, includes trash collection, which has been a long staple of money and resources for the mafia. And the reformist-minded mayor here, he basically decided he wanted to clean up that bidding process. But anyway, the trash collectors decided, well, you want to clean up this situation, we're going to slow things down, meaning that there's trash all over the city of Rome. That situation was exacerbated by this ironic effort to clean up the city of corruption. And this while a conference of mayors is going on, convened by the Pope, directed at, as you pointed out, Aaron, environmental degradation. It's quite ironic.
Now, the mayor of Rome, of course, was at the Vatican conference. Was he a bit embarrassed by all this?
I don't think he was embarrassed by this. I think he's more embarrassed by his popularity, which has plummeted here in recent months because, ironically, again, of what many feel is a sincere effort to clean up the city.
Let's get back to the meeting itself. Why did Pope Francis call the meeting, and what is the connection between climate change and human trafficking?
I think one of the more unusual aspects of this meeting is how these issues have basically been discussed. This was seen as a symbiosis of concerns. The Pope, as you know, has issued several calls to action focused on the consequences of climate change. And one of those consequences, he believes, is human trafficking. Individuals who are forced from their lands, from their countries, because of climate conditions. Things are getting worse. Crops are dying. And so they're on the move. And those migrants, the Pope believes, are subject to human trafficking to get from Libya, for example, to Lampedusa, and from Lampedusa to Italy, and from Italy further north. Oftentimes, they have to enter into contracts. And what the Pope is saying is that these things are, in fact, connected, that human trafficking is, in fact, exacerbated by climate change.
So, Philip, what was the outcome of the meeting? Did the mayors agree on a plan of action?
The mayors agreed that they, first of all, will tackle problems within their own cities. This was, in fact, a strategy on the part of the Pope to use mayors to attack problems on the local level. He considered that extraordinarily important. Secondarily, they signed a declaration committing to tackle climate change and human trafficking. And the Pope basically has put it in the hands of city leaders to take a leadership role that their legislators on the federal level may not be taking and oftentimes aren't taking.
Now, as luck or maybe fate would have it, the mayors found themselves talking about a warming climate during a really hot week in Rome. How did that work out?
The irony did not escape anyone. It was quite remarkable to watch these mayors from Johannesburg and from Paris and Oslo and any number of places as the air conditioner was trying to churn out a decent amount of air. And so and this, of course, invited chuckles from some reporters to see mayors fanning themselves and talking about climate change and global warming.
Philip Martin of our station here, WGBH, speaking to us from Rome. Thanks, Philip.
Thank you, Aaron.
Coming up, a way to beat the heat here in the U.S., summer movies. No dinosaurs or superheroes here on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter. He's from Kazakhstan but lives in L.A. And he's an opera singer who also fronts a glam rock outfit with a new album.
I would describe Collapse as a ride to the end of the world and with a glass of champagne.
He's Timur, not Borat, and his story is coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from Curious.com, helping people grow skills in areas like programming and parenting, broadcasting a live discussion on how to raise an adult with author Julie Lithcott-Hames tonight at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. And by LegalZoom, dedicated to providing legal help to all Americans through online services, personal customer support, and legal advice through independent attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 20 years ago, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was murdered. Rabin was on the verge of making a peace agreement with the Palestinians when he was shot dead at a rally in Tel Aviv. The assassin was Yigal Amir, an ultra-nationalist Israeli who opposed Rabin's moves toward peace. Amir is now serving a life sentence as Israel's most vilified prisoner. But the story doesn't end there, because Amir married and fathered a child after he was put behind bars. Now, a new documentary about Amir's family has created an uproar in Israel. Daniel Estrin has the story.
Israeli filmmakers usually love to tackle their country's sore spots. But the family life of a man who assassinated Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is probably Israel's biggest sore spot. No one had ever done a documentary film about it until now. The documentary opens with dramatic views of the Israeli desert, where Yigal Amir is held in a maximum security prison in solitary confinement. And you see Amir's wife and young son driving down to visit him. The film is called Beyond the Fear, which partly refers to the fears of the filmmakers about whether to do this film at all. I spoke with Israeli documentary scholar Shmulik Duvdevani. He explains the dilemma.
What does it mean that you are going to make a film about Yigal Amir? How are you going to present him? Are you going to show him as, you know, as a human being, or are you going to show him as a monstrous entity, you know, the one who assassinated not only Yitzhak Rabin, but assassinated the Israeli quest for peace?
The film offers a non-judgmental look at Amir's family. His wife is a Moscow-born immigrant to Israel named Larisa Trembovler. She began writing to Amir when he was put in prison. She was sympathetic to his cause, opposing Rabin's moves toward peace. She got permission to visit Amir, fell in love, divorced her then-husband, and married Amir. There's just one very short scene in the film where she talks about her husband's actions. She says she saw Amir as an idealist, a good person who was driven to despair and sacrificed himself for the sake of others. After a very public court battle, she and Amir won the right to a conjugal visit, and their son Yinon was born. The film includes tape recordings of the bedtime stories Amir tells his young son over a phone from prison. They're some of the most hypnotizing parts of the film. Amir tells his son stories about biblical heroes who acted alone and persevered with God's help. Film critics in Israel have said Amir seems to portray himself to his son as a biblical hero. The whole thing sparked a scandal in Israel. The culture minister threatened to cut government funding to a prestigious Israeli film festival if it screened the film. The film ended up getting two back-to-back screenings. Amiram Goldblum was there to protest.
This film is in support of a murderer who did the worst murder in the history of Israel. And this is unacceptable that support to this murderer after 20 years that he's in jail will be shown in the main Israeli film festival.
I asked Russian co-director Maria Kravchenko what she hoped Israeli audiences would take away from the film.
I don't think that people will change their minds about the characters of the film or about the events that are described there, but I just want them to stop for a moment and think if everything is really so one-sided in life.
Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the screening of Behind the Fear, directed by...
I went to the film's Israeli premiere and sat in the second-to-last row, next to a religious Jewish Israeli doctor named Nechama Peretz. She was born in the Soviet Union, like Yigal Amir's wife. She told me she felt sympathy with Amir's ideas and had even befriended his wife. But she says she's hesitant to speak about that openly in Israel. When the film ended, I asked her what she thought. She said it was a rare, sympathetic portrait of Amir's family.
I think it's important for everyone to see. This film maybe takes us out of our comfortable area to see Yigal Amir's family and to think.
Some people think Amir's wife has made a noble sacrifice. Some think she's crazy. And a lot of people simply don't think too much about it. When Israel locked Yigal Amir in a prison nearly 20 years ago, Many Israelis put the whole affair, the assassination of a man striving for peace, out of sight and out of mind. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Here at home, it's a different sort of film that people are talking about. The blockbuster is alive and kicking, much like those dinosaurs on Jurassic World. But if big action summer flicks just aren't your thing, no worries. I've got Matt Holtzman here to talk about some of his favorite foreign films coming out. Matt hosts the screening series First Take for KCRW in Los Angeles. All right, Matt, three foreign film recommendations for us. Shoot.
First one is Victoria, which is a German movie. It's a really remarkable film that was shot in a single take, 2.5 hours in one single take.
What?
And I know. It's one of those movies where you don't even notice that until someone tells you later. It's the story of a young girl who's moved to Berlin. She's left Spain. We don't know why. She meets up with a couple of guys on the street in Berlin. They hang out. And it's a heist film, and that's how it's being marketed. And you can't figure out how these people who are just hanging out on the street are going to be involved in a heist. But the first hour tells you everything you need to know about the characters. And so when they do get involved in the heist and things go invariably wrong, you care so much about what happens with them. And because it's done in a first take, there is a certain kind of immediacy, like you're really there through the whole thing.
Okay, now the second film you've chosen could be the opposite of a crime film. It's The Second Mother, a film out of Brazil. What is that one about?
The Second Mother is the story of Val. She's a middle-aged maid in a wealthy Brazilian home, and she's kind of part of the family. She's the second mother to their son, and yet she's also very much not a part of the family. She doesn't sit down at the table with the family. She cannot go in the pool. And there is something about these rules that somehow gives her kind of a sense of well-being until her daughter, her estranged daughter, shows up. And her daughter is not bound by any of those rules. And when the family invites the daughter to sit down at their table, they're doing it to be genteel, but they don't expect that she's going to sit down at the table because there are these unspoken rules. And when she does sit down at the table, you are shocked because these rules are being violated. They're being shattered. And as the young girl continues to shatter the social rules, the mother starts to see that she's been living in this cage, and she finally, you know, frees herself of the rules. And you just see this middle-aged woman kind of blossom, and it's wonderful.
You know, that's incredible because this story is so universal around the world where everybody has help.
Right. Well, it's particularly interesting for an American audience because we often have help. You know, middle-class people have a housekeeper or they have a nanny, and our relationship to those people we think is a better relationship. But in fact, we have social rules as well. And seeing those rules kind of bared right before you makes you very self-conscious of the fact that in any one of these situations, whether you're in Brazil or whether you're in Los Angeles, we are kind of bounded by the social rules that we all kind of agree to as we get into these relationships.
And finally, Matt, you're going to leave us with one film that you haven't actually seen but are looking forward to. Tell us about that.
Yeah, very much so. And I should say also that technically it's not a foreign film. It's called Beasts of No Nation. And it's the story of a child soldier in a West African country that goes unnamed. It's based on a novel by a Nigerian-American author named Uzodinma Awiala. And what makes this movie exciting is that it's directed by Cary Fukunaga. And if you remember back
true
in 2009.
Detective, right?
Right. Well, in 2009, he directed a feature film called Sin Nombre, which was the story of a Honduran girl and a gangster who are trying to get to the United States. He managed to take us there in a way that was so moving, and to take what is, you know, immigration, a social issue, I'm making air quotes right now, and he makes the story so personal and makes us understand what the people are going through who experience these quote-unquote social issues. And I imagine that this film is going to do the same thing. It's very hard, I think, for an American to even imagine what it must be like for a child who is brought into an army and is forced to fight. And I think that this director is going to be able to take that story and bring us into it in a way that will make us understand a little better what people are going through there.
Matt Holtzman, you make air quotes sound so good.
Thank you very much.
Matt is host of the screening series First Take at KCRW in Los Angeles. Always great to chat with you. Thanks.
Good to talk to you.
We don't feature a lot of opera singers here on The World, so we're going to rectify that right now. Here's Alina Simone with the story of a tenor from Kazakhstan who sings opera and a whole lot more.
The story of how Timur Bekbasunov became a glam rock opera singer in the U.S. actually began in 1958 in Almaty, Kazakhstan, then part of the Soviet Union. Timur's father developed a strange idea one day.
Hey, I want to go to the United States and see what it's all about.
His dad even wrote a letter to Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev to see if the Communist Party would send him here. Unsurprisingly, he never heard back, but he also never forgot America. So in 1996, when Timur was 15...
He surprised me one day saying that, hey, guess what? I submitted all of your documents for this program, and you got accepted, so you're going there to study English, and it's going to be just for 1 year.
Timur ended up in Kansas, living with a nurse who became his adopted American mother, and encouraged him...
Kind of, I guess, as corny as it sounds, to follow your dreams, and so I started to sing.
Which is how Timur ended up being discovered, singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow at a festival in Kansas by a scout from Wichita State University. That's where he discovered opera.
And I really began to, you know, enter this really strange, beautiful world of sometimes abstract and sometimes ephemeral way of singing. Then I really like that. It's kind of an out-of-body experience when you sing. And opera felt very natural in that sense.
Since then, he's performed all over the world, at the Hollywood Bowl, with the LA Philharmonic, and in Kazakhstan. He went back as a soloist and producer of his own opera, The Silent Step Cantata.
The music is composed for the Kazakh folk instruments, so there are no Western instruments. There are others like kobuz, kilkobuz, dombra, and things like that. So that makes it very, very unusual sound.
The thing is, the people playing all those instruments, none of them were from Kazakhstan. The large ensemble Timur brought with him were mostly Westerners, which led to some friction, like the time...
This director of this hall just bursts in and interrupts the rehearsal and says, no, it's all over, you know, you don't have a permission to be here. And so they cut off the rehearsal. There are people, the television cameras there, and he just makes this big, big stink about the whole thing. And he said that, you know, we were plotting to shoot Borat 2.
I'm just glad I wasn't the first one to bring up Borat, the 2006 film that Kazakhstan once banned and officials denounced as humiliating.
My name is Borat. I'm a journalist for Kazakhstan. My government sent me to USA to make a movie film.
But the country's actually mellowed out on Borat considerably, Timur tells me. A couple of years ago, the foreign ministry even thanked Sacha Baron Cohen for boosting tourism. Back in the U.S., Timur continued to move into musical genres that defy classification. Take his band, Timur and the Dime Museum.
What we're doing now could be described as proto-punk and minimalist chamber pop at times, and it has this really great rock opera sort of segment to it.
The glamier influences of the Russian, American, and European pop music he grew up listening to can also be heard on their forthcoming album, The Collapse. Fun, right? Except the album is supposed to be a dark requiem about man-made ecological disasters.
I would describe Collapse as a ride to the end of the world, and with a glass of champagne, if you can say that.
You can take that ride in Brooklyn this fall, where Timur and his band will perform The Collapse at BAM's Next Wave Festival. The other big project Timur is focusing on? His dad. Oddly, their roles have now reversed. Timur wants his dad to join him in Los Angeles. But after spending his whole life in Kazakhstan, his father has mixed feelings about leaving.
But I'm trying to convince him that this is a good country, too.
Last month, Timur's adopted American mother passed away. And his biological mom died last year.
It's funny because I always felt I was the luckiest person because I had two mothers, one in Kazakhstan and one in the United States. And then suddenly it's like at this point I don't have two mothers, so I only have my dad, and I told him that he has to step up his game, you know, and so he better be ready for it when we get to the United States. I'm going to smother him with love.
Sounds like his dad's letter to Khrushchev is finally being answered, 50 years later. For the world, this is Alina Simone.
And we're premiering the video of another Timur and the Dime Museum song, Heat, Beat, and Retreat. That's at PRI.org. And you are listening to The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis, AmericanGraduate.org, and by Curious.com, helping people grow skills in areas like programming and parenting, broadcasting a live discussion on how to raise an adult with author Julie Lithcott-Hames tonight at 9:30 Eastern, Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Aaron Schachter with The World. As we heard earlier, President Obama is flying tonight to Kenya. He'll no doubt be greeted by large crowds in his father's homeland, and authorities in the capital, Nairobi, are taking lots of security precautions.
I mean, we're talking about full-on lockdown of the city. You can't even drive a car past 2 p.m. tomorrow, really. You know, just outside the door, along with people painting murals and pictures of President Obama awaiting his arrival tomorrow, you're also seeing men with, you know, semi-automatic weapons, maybe five per block. The security is unreal.
My colleague Matt Danzico is in Nairobi with the BBC pop-up team. What's the idea behind the pop-up teams, and what are you doing there in Kenya?
So the idea of BBC pop-up is we're effectively a crowdsourcing unit. So what we do is we hold meetups or town meetings, and we ask locals to come out and tell us what stories they want us to cover. And then we just film their story suggestions. And so what we've been doing is we held a town meeting actually before we even left. I'm based in the U.S., so I'm the rogue American in the unit. And so I held a town meeting in Dallas, Texas. We collected story ideas there. And then I flew to Nairobi, and we've been generating story ideas here within various sort of spots around the city. And so all in all, we have 146 story suggestions.
Give us an idea of two or three story ideas you got that maybe you wouldn't have covered if left to your own devices.
There are so many story ideas.
Well, I know. Again, you said 146 you're looking at, but two or three interesting ones.
So we have everything from Sir Elvis, a Kenyan country western musician with a very, very deep voice, to the issue of tourism. So tourists around the country get charged a much different price than locals and get greeted in using different language. We also have LGBT issues. It is illegal to commit homosexual acts within the country's borders. So that has been brought up to us. Kenyan film industry, there is a large bubbling film industry in some of the largest African slums here. Kids are sort of picking up video cameras as a way to escape poverty. Other things include donkey welfare. Kenya has a large population of donkeys. There are nonprofit groups going around the country to try to make sure all these donkeys are fit and healthy. And so those are just some of the stories that we've received.
Now, one story idea you got was to investigate how many languages are spoken in Kenya. And to shoot video on this, you chose one of the largest slums in Africa, a crowded and bustling community, Kibera, I believe, right? What did you find there?
So Kibera is a very interesting place. And we went there at 8 o'clock in the morning on the first day that the team arrived. And we were able to walk down a city block and manage to speak to people speaking 10 different languages. There are more than 60 languages spoken here in Kenya, and a huge amount of the diversity of the city is actually seen in some of Kenya's slums. These are vibrant communities. Granted, they are quite poor, but they are vibrant communities where you're likely to see people from across Africa, kids playing in the streets. I mean, it's not sort of the type of setting that you would imagine when you hear the word slum.
Matt, you came across a couple of young men speaking a slang called sheng. We're going to hear a little bit of it now.
So can you just explain to me what language you guys are speaking and why?
We are talking sheng because we need to do business.
It's important because it differentiates us from the adults. Because when we talk, they don't understand us, so we understand ourselves better.
Okay, so it's kind of a business slang. You think that could come up at summit with President Obama?
I don't know if it could, but it should. Sheng represents the youth of Kenya, and the youth of Kenya really are the ones responsible for creating these startups. They're the ones bringing in the international business, and they're the ones creating a culture of hope and diversity inside Nairobi, at the very least.
Matt, do you get the feeling that Obama is going to receive a warm welcome?
All right, let me just put it in perspective for you. If I walk out of the office right here, here in downtown Nairobi, I will probably see at least four people painting pictures of President Obama. The local news channel on its Twitter page has a banner saying, "Welcome home, President Obama." Certainly, the people of Kenya are looking to embrace him with open arms, and that's putting it very lightly.
There is an American cable network that called Kenya a hotbed of terror. Whether or not that's true, there are definitely security concerns about the president's visit. Can you see that on the streets of Nairobi where you are?
You can certainly see it on the streets. I mean, the amount of men, combined with the people painting pictures of President Obama outside, the amount of men holding machine guns is really interesting. We're seeing people in fatigues, maybe five per block. They're just hitting the streets like you wouldn't believe. So I think Kenyans are hopeful. I mean, this is a hub of international business. This is a place that has embraced its startup tech scene. Granted, it's dealing with some very heavy issues like terror attacks, but to say it's a hotbed of terrorism is going a bit far.
Matt Danzico is in Nairobi with the BBC pop-up team. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We close today's program with music by Mano Swezi. The band's name refers to the four countries the musicians come from: Mozambique, Norway, Sweden, and Zimbabwe. Mano Swezi. The lead singer is Hope Masike. She also plays the mbira, or thumb piano, and that in itself is a bit unusual. You see, in Zimbabwe, the mbira is traditionally played by men. Then again, with musicians from Africa and Scandinavia, Mano Swezi is not your traditional band. Sure, the saxophone, clarinet, bass, and drums help keep the tempo and add a jazz influence, but it's the mbira that adds texture, and the voice of Hope Masike ties everything together. Mano Swezi puts the finishing touch on our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, and the Billy and Dodie Crockett Advised Fund of the Dallas Foundation. By the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. By the Annenberg Foundation, Advancing a Better Tomorrow Through Visionary Leadership Today, annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.